was created, the deed did not quite reflect that. And I have asked Ms. Mills to provide the justices exhibits. There's three pages, exhibits A, B, and C. And I'd just like to point you to exhibit C, which was the first iteration, not that that was controlling of the transaction, but you'll see in my highlighted portion, it says, seller reserves all of the minerals estate owned by the seller until buyer pays off the loan. That was the first contract. If you would look at exhibit A, which is signed by the parties, which is what we're complaining about, this is this exact same wording is on there, except in addition, it says seller is not allowed to sell any of the minerals slash royalties reserved. So when we get to the deed, Mr. Marsh, of course, thought that he would not own the minerals. Ms. Martinez would own the minerals until he paid off the loan. When you get to the deed, exhibit B, the deed says in that last paragraph there, further save and accept, that the grantor reserves and retains the minerals. And then when you go down to the very last sentence, it says, notwithstanding the foregoing, grantor shall not sell any part of the foregoing mineral estate or any part thereof while any of the foregoing promissory note remains unpaid. So Mr. Marsh was told, as he has stated in his affidavit to the motion for summary judgment, that this was exactly as he intended it for it to be, which was that Ms. Martinez would own the minerals. And Mr. Martinez died in the ensuing years, so I'm going to talk about Ms. Martinez. But the Martinezes retained the minerals. Mr. Marsh understood that, but he would get the minerals when he paid off the note. He paid off the note October of 2017. He began trying to get the minerals. He finally, as he says in his affidavit, on September the 8th, September of 2018, he was told that she was not going to transfer the minerals to him. There was some back and forth about the estate of Mr. Martinez and how that would play into deeds. But finally, in September, he was told that he was not going to get the minerals. He had no way of knowing, because the transaction was such that he didn't expect any bonus money. He didn't expect any oil companies to come talk to him. He didn't expect any royalties from the time that he purchased the property to the time that he paid off the property. As soon as he paid off the property, he began asking for the minerals. And so
does the fact that the deed not accurately reflect what the sale of contract indicates, isn't that enough to give him notice that there was an issue with it when that was first executed and not when he tried to enforce it?
Well, the deed, Justice, did reflect what the contract said. If you'll look at the contract, C, it says that the seller reserves all the minerals of the mineral estate until the buyer pays off the loan. And that, I'm sorry, it's exhibit A. And the seller is not allowed to sell any of the minerals or royalties reserved. Now, the deed said that the seller reserves the minerals just as the contract says. And down here it says that he is not allowed to sell the mineral estate or any part of it while the promissory note. There's no reason for that, especially in a layperson's mind. There's no reason for that except for the fact that the minerals are going to be given to him at the time that he pays off the loan. So the answer.
But counsel, couldn't it also mean that the grantor in this case agreed, sort of more like an option for a purchase to occur later on by your client? I mean, to me, the deed is ambiguous in that it doesn't specify what's supposed to happen at the end of the payment of the promissory note. It could be one that at that point, there's an option to buy by your client. There's an option, or they can sell it to a third party. Or, I mean, there's various things that could have, the way it's written. Obviously, your client had an idea that they it would pass to him, but it would have been so easy to just add two or three little words to that deed and said, upon which time the mineral rights will be conveyed to the buyer or to the grantee, or, you know, but that's not in there. So just by if a person, I guess, read the deed, there is some, not necessarily ambiguity, but, well, more like omission of language. So therefore, going to the statute of limitations, if the legal effect of this language is immediately apparent, then at that point, doesn't the 4 years start to run, and their argument, therefore, does you know, hold water, I guess.
No, Justice Hinojosa, I do believe in your first comment that you said the deed was ambiguous and it looks ambiguous. That's the perfect reason not to grant a summary judgment. That would we would be able to come in and have a fact issue. We would be allowed to then show extrinsic evidence, and a jury could decide whether or not that was what the parties intended. You're supposed to look to what the parties intended. If the deed is ambiguous, as we pled, then a summary judgment is not right. There is a big distinction between the what a grantor is known and what a grantee is known. And in the appellee, Ms. Martinez, has relied on the case that said that talks about the grantor, which is if the deed is unambiguous and if there's a complete omission, then there's an irrebuttable presumption that you understood the deed. But that's the only way. Brown versus Havard says that. Martin versus Miles says that if there's not those things, number one, there's an ambiguity, because what does it mean that she can't sell the property? That doesn't, if there was a complete reservation, that can't mean anything. That makes it ambiguous.
Mr. Gosselin?
Jaime, you're breaking up.
What I'm thinking is that even under the perfect of circumstances in this deal, after the completion of the payment, because no payment and the deed only says that they can't sell it, nobody knows whether or not the note was ever paid, because it's got a vendor's lien on. I mean, wouldn't there be something else filed to let the world know that the note has been paid and now the buyer has possession of the mineral estate?
You were breaking up on me a little bit, Justice, but I believe your question was, wasn't there something else that would have been filed? And I think that certainly the we expected something else to be filed in October of 2017. And that would be, since the reservation in the contract says that the seller sells, reserves the minerals of the mineral estate owned by seller until buyer pays off loan. And that means that she doesn't reserve them anymore after the buyer pays off loan. And so, yes, there would be something that would reflect that. And so what reflected that in the deed is it put people on notice that there may be another transaction afterwards. Grantor can't sell these minerals during the time period that the note was in place. So it is that we expected that. We did not expect for them not to do what they said under the contract. We had no idea. We had no reason to think that the deed didn't reflect the very thing that it said in the contract. And that's why the discovery rule doesn't apply. I mean, the statute of limitation doesn't apply because we could not have expected that, nor Could we really have made them do anything else until we paid off the note? And once we paid off the note, we began immediately trying to get the minerals transferred to us as reflected in the affidavits there in the motion for summary judgment. In addition, the court granted summary judgment against our breach of contract claim, which we have a breach of contract claim that says that even if all of those arguments work or the court buys those arguments, the contracts contemplates that there will be another transaction. So if I had a contract that said I sell tract A and tract B to you, and you say okay, and I only give you a deed for tract A, you can still file a breach of contract on me to transfer to you tract B. And that's what happened. We have the surface estate, we have the mineral estate. We agreed that we could have the surface estate immediately, and we would have the mineral estate at a later date to be determined whenever we paid off the loan. We paid off the loan. They have not transferred that estate. The motion for summary judgment didn't ask for a summary judgment related to the breach of contract. We have also asked for a declaratory judgment to declare whether or not the deed actually transferred that. The motion for summary judgment did not contemplate or ask specifically for a motion for summary judgment on the declaratory judgment action, yet the court ruled a final summary judgment on everything, even though the motion for summary judgment was clearly on only the reformation and statute of limitations related to the reformation. So for those
counsel, you started to talk, I guess, about the Cosgrove case.
Correct.
I guess you argue that it applies to only actions brought by the grantor, but doesn't Cosgrove explicitly state that this rule applies to both parties?
I don't think that that's accurate, let me rephrase that. I do think that that rule would apply to both parties if you had an unambiguous deed, and B, the grantor had been the one that executed the deed. The Supreme Court and the courts of appeals have always looked at grantors more harshly than grantees. Grantors are the ones that are drafting the deeds, that are giving the deeds. But Cosgrove was very specifically an unambiguous deed that where there was nothing in the deed other than a non-reservation. In other words, it was a case where the seller had reserved the minerals in the contract, but there was nothing in the deed. And so the court said the deed is unambiguous and it's clear on the face that there is nothing in the deed. Not one thing that would put a grantor, the grantor, not on notice that the minerals were changing. Here, that's not the case. Number one, it is not an unambiguous deed, and there is something in there that reflects what the contract language says very specifically. I mean, and it makes sense that this contract language or this language would say, I am going to transfer these later on, and I am not going to sell this during that transfer, because that's what Mr. Marsh was concerned about. And you can see that phrase was added into the contract to say, okay, I need some extra protection here because I don't want you to sell these while I'm paying off this note, because I intend to get them. So the intent of the parties was clearly that these minerals would transfer once this note was paid off, and that's not what happened. And for those reasons, we would ask that you reverse the district court and remand this back so that we can look at the fact issues. Thank you.
Any other questions from Justice Hinojosa or Justice Tejeda? All right. Mr. Fusco, you may begin. Your clock is ready to go.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Nick Fusco, and I am counsel for the appellee, Ms. Manuela Martinez. Ms. Martinez is an 83-year-old widow and who resides in Burleson County, and this lawsuit involves her homestead property. This is a plain and simple deed reformation case. This case was originally filed by the appellant asking the court to reform an unambiguous deed due to an alleged material omission. However, the appellant waited more than 4 years from the date that the deed was executed by both parties in this case, including the grantee, who is the appellant here, and it was recorded in the public records more than 4 years before the lawsuit was filed. And so the Cosgrove Court in 2015 had it made a ruling, a very clear and concise holding that says that parties are charged as a, parties being the key distinction here, parties are charged as a matter of law with knowledge of an unambiguous deed's material omissions from the date of execution and limitations runs from that date. And so the central contention in this case is the appellant's argument that the deed should have included, or in his words, quote, mistakenly omits a term reservation of the mineral estate in his favor. There is no dispute in this case that the deed as written does not include a term reservation of the mineral estate. And there is also no dispute in this case that the deed as written contains a full and complete reservation of the mineral estate in favor of Ms. Martinez, her heirs, and assigns, using the usual and customary language in order to make that reservation in the face of the deed. And the opposing counsel wants to argue that the mineral reservation language in the deed is somehow ambiguous, but his argument is entirely reliant on extrinsic evidence. The merger doctrine applies in property law just as the parole evidence rule applies in contract law. And the merger doctrine in this case would preclude the consideration of any extrinsic evidence unless the deed is considered to be ambiguous. And so the ultimate determination in this case revolves around the court's decision as to whether or not the deed as written is ambiguous. And when the court, the question of ambiguity is a question of law for the court to decide. And so in this case, the trial court decided that the deed as written is unambiguous. And when we look at an ambiguity analysis, the court, the Texas Supreme Court, has been abundantly clear that the fundamental rule of deed interpretation is the four corners rule, which requires the court to constrain its analysis to the four corners of the subject deed to determine the party's intent. It is not the court's job to look outside the four corners of the deed to try to determine a subjective intent that is not reflected in the deed itself.
Okay, so Mr. Counsel, Fusco, Okay, so if we look at the four corners of the deed, and specifically the language that we've been referring to this afternoon, where your client cannot sell the mineral rights, and then it ends there, does that language not create an ambiguity because it doesn't tell us what happens to the mineral interest? It leaves us dangling. And we are reviewing that as a matter of law, are we not? It doesn't matter what the trial court found. We get to look at it as a matter of law.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I would respectfully just disagree on the issue of that the deed does not address what happens when the note is paid. The deed at question here includes language that says that there is accepted from this conveyance and not conveyed hereby, and the grantor retains and reserves unto the grantor's heirs and assigns all of the minerals currently owned by the grantor. And so the language that the appellant is trying to direct the court to is a simple and reasonable restraint on alienation. Those are done all the time. It's reasonable in this case because all that was an opportunity to provide the appellant an additional chance to make a subsequent purchase or offer. It's clear that he needed to finance the original purchase price. And so he wanted the ability to make that additional offer.
Okay, counsel, let me interrupt you there, but I agree with if the deed had ended where you ended your reading of it, then that would be clearly unambiguous. But it goes on to say that neither grantor nor grantor's heirs shall have any right to ingress or egress over the surface for the purpose of exploration or development of minerals or any other purpose. So effectively, aren't you all like at a standstill? I mean, your clients can't go onto the property because they don't own the surface, but yet the mineral rights you're saying are retained by your client. So therefore, there's never going to be, if we agree with you, then there would never be any development of mineral rights on this property because they could just say, no, you're not coming onto the property. And your client could say, well, you don't have access to the mineral, so you can't. So there's going to be no exploration on this property. Isn't that sort of, you know, a ludicrous kind of conclusion?
An ambiguous conclusion?
Yeah, ambiguous. And I haven't even gotten to the last part where it says that they're not supposed to sell the property until it gets paid, or the mineral rights. So what value are mineral rights going to have to anyone if the person who buys the mineral rights wouldn't ever have any ability to go onto the property to do any exploration on it? I mean, the only person who would benefit from buying the mineral rights or owning the mineral rights are Mr. Marsh. If we read it within the four corners.
Respectfully, this language that you're referring to is very commonplace in oil and gas development cases, because what you have read and the following two provisions following that sentence clearly creates the impression that there will be surface protections for the surface owner, that when the mineral owner decides to develop the mineral estate or lease it, that the lessee, so the oil company in that case, would have to abide by the surface use restrictions relevant to the surface ownership. Mm-hmm. And so it is common all over the place that when minerals and surface are divided, that the surface owner requests these types of protections so that way that the surface owner can be in control of the development and use of that surface. But by no means does that reach an absurd or ludicrous conclusion. It's actually quite common. And to me, it reflects the very agreement that is shown in the document, which is Mr. Marsh asked for surface use protections because he didn't own the minerals. If he owned the minerals, why would he need surface use protections from himself? And so the surface use protection language, it clearly says there that in that same paragraph, that nothing contained herein shall preclude grantor, grantor's heirs or assigns from executing oil and gas leases. That is a very clear intention that the grantor and their heirs would reserve the right rules. And in these kind of cases where we have smaller tracts like this one, the oil companies typically put them into a unit. And so when the oil company goes to develop particular tracts, one of the very first things they look at is what protections or obligations do I have as the lessee relating to the surface that I'm wanting to develop. And so these are exactly what you would want to see when there is a bifurcation of ownership between the surface owner and the mineral owner. And the language at the end of that paragraph is quite clear. It creates a period of time from which Mr. Marsh would be able to buy the minerals if Mr. and Mrs. Martinez wanted to sell them, and if he had the ability to buy them. There was no obligation contained anywhere in the deed itself that talks about the minerals being conveyed to anyone. The only language relating to the minerals in the deed is a full and complete reservation in favor of Ms. Martinez with surface protections for Mr. Marsh. And so,
okay, now let me ask you this other question. You didn't argue that the limitations is barred the declaratory judgment and breach of contract action in your summary judgment motion. Explain how this court can affirm the dismissal of all those other claims if the case law is pretty clear that if all these issues are not addressed in the summary judgment motion, it's erred by the trial court and is generally reversible. So tell us, didn't that other cause or those other two causes of action survive?
No, Your Honor, they did not. And the reason is because if you look at Cosgrove, the Cosgrove court says that a breach of contract and declaratory judgment action in these kinds of transactions are available only if the party is able to reform the underlying deed and prove a superior right. So the summary judgment that was filed addressed the deed reformation. And once the trial court decided that the deed in this case could not be reformed, then the other causes of action became moot and were no longer available, and they were barred by as a matter of law. And one specific point that I'd like to raise on the breach of contract claim, the appellant's argument on appeal relating to this breach of contract claim is a new argument that was never raised in trial, and that there is no competent summary judgment evidence at all in the record before this court as to the underlying terms of the sales contract. The appellant can only cite the court to a single page of a 16-page contract. The final contract is not part of this record. And the reason is because in the trial court, the appellant was arguing that the breach in this case was that the deed failed to include a term reservation in the mineral estate. And his argument was the contract required that. He didn't argue, as he is now arguing on appeal, that the contract created two separate and distinct obligations to make separate conveyances. And so the court has no competent summary judgment evidence before it relating to the terms of the underlying sales contract, because the final sales contract is not part of the record. Because number one, they were never arguing it in the trial court. And number two, it's been raised for the first time on appeal to try to circumvent the application of Cosgrove. And if you draw the argument relating to breach of contract to its logical conclusion, it actually is directly opposite of his deed reformation claim. This argument was raised for the first time on appeal and is not supported by any competent summary judgment evidence in the record. The summary judgment or the record before this court and the evidence that was presented to the trial court does not include the sales contract that is underlying this transaction. And so,
but counsel, wouldn't you agree that, my question is, how do we consider this argument when you did not file a no evidence summary, motion for summary judgment as to that claim? Just thinking logistically as to how all this came about.
Absolutely. And so I think maybe having a little understanding of what the way the pleadings were pled may help. This case was initially filed by the appellant strictly as a deed reformation and declaratory judgment act. There was no breach of contract claim whatsoever. Once I filed my first motion for summary judgment, they amended their pleading to add a breach of contract to prevent summary judgment, at which point we then had a subsequent summary judgment hearing, which again was revolving around the issue of reformation. And so the Cosgrove court says that if a deed can't be reformed, then the deed stands unreformed and all the other claims and causes of action are not available. And so the threshold inquiry in this case is whether or not the deed is subject to reformation. And it's clear that if we apply a plain reading to this deed and do not distract ourselves with the evidence that it's inadmissible that the appellant is relying on, then the document, you reach one certain and legal conclusion. And that is that there was a full reservation that the grantee negotiated and received surface protections from development of the mineral estate that he clearly didn't anticipate owning, or else he wouldn't need those protections from himself. And two, we created a very reasonable restraint on alienation relating to those minerals while the underlying deed was, or the underlying note was being paid. And so the declaratory judgment and breach of contract claims become moot once the deed cannot be reformed. The merger doctrine, which was actually just recently reaffirmed by the Texas Supreme Court in a case that was issued 10 days after I submitted my brief, which is Chicago Title v. Cochran, it very clearly says in that case that the merger doctrine applies to bar claim a breach of contract claim based on evidence that the contract's terms conflicted with the terms in the deed. That is, this case is the classic example of why the merger doctrine should apply, because the merger doctrine applies relating to the term or relating to claims concerning the scope of conveyance. That is precisely what the appellant is arguing here, which is that the scope of conveyance terms in the contract conflicted with the terms that were ultimately put in the deed. And the courts, it is well settled Texas law that the deeds in a real property transaction are presumed to be the final expression of intent of the parties, and that the courts are required to look to the deed alone to determine that intent. And this court has held routinely in cases that I cited in my brief that the underlying sales contract in real property conveyances becomes, as this court used the word, functus officio, which means null and void. Underlying sales contract becomes null and void whenever a deed is tendered in performance of a contract to convey. And all of the terms of the underlying contract are merged and are subsumed into that deed. And so if we look to the deed alone in this case, that deed is unambiguous. And that deed very clearly makes a full and complete reservation in favor of Ms. Martinez and her
heir. So Mr. Fusco, what you're saying is that when you look at the deed alone, that their intention was to just have a reservation in the sale of the mineral estate during the loan period, and that there was never any intention on conveying the mineral estate at the end of the, or when the loan matured.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I think that that interpretation is only reinforced, even if you were to look at the sales contract.
Well, you mentioned that that reservation language was usual and customary. I know they have the promulgated forms in the form of a booklet that you can probably get electronically now if you are in the real estate business. But usual and customary, that doesn't cross my mind when you have a reservation and a deed of a mineral estate during a loan period. Is that usual and customary?
Let me answer the question by saying that what I was talking about being usual and customary was the language relating to the reservation of the mineral estate. So that first provision saying that there's the grantor.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with that, and I would agree with you. But then I would also have to say that the last line is not usual and customary. And so that begs the question: is it usual and customary to reserve just the sale of a mineral estate during a loan period?
I don't think that it would be fair to say it's usual and customary to do that. But I don't think there's any rule or principle that would preclude parties that have the free right to contract and to negotiate terms to agree to a very reasonable and limited restraint on alienation in this case. And so,
well, yeah, but if we get to the merits of the breach of contract claim, you know, would you agree or disagree with the fact that that language is in there, that last sentence, wouldn't that implicate that there was maybe no meeting of the minds, or there's basically an exception to the merger doctrine because the deed constitutes only a partial performance of the purchase contract, you know, whereby, you know, there would be evidence where their client would say this language indicated that it was supposed to be conveyed to me, and your client would say, no, I was just giving him basically an option to buy at the end of the contract period. And wouldn't that create a fact question that wouldn't survive summary judgment?
No, Your Honor, there is no fact question, because that language isn't ambiguous unless you are to buy in or listen to the arguments that are being raised based on evidence that is not properly before the court, that's inadmissible. The merger doctrine applies to the scope of conveyance. And so the exceptions to the merger doctrine are not applicable here, because the argument from the other side is that this is a that the deed's conveyance language is inaccurate. And I noticed that my time is up, and so I wanted to, may I briefly conclude?
You may finish here, of course. Thank you.
And so in closing here, I would first like to just say thank you for your time and consideration of my argument here today. And for the reasons that we have discussed, I believe that this court should ultimately conclude that the deed in this case is unambiguous, and that it's that the trial court made the correct decision based on the evidence and arguments that were before it, and that the trial court's decision should be affirmed, and that this court should conclude that the deed in this case speaks for itself. Thank you.
I would just like to address a couple of the things that were raised. Number one, the Four Corners doctrine does not have anything to do with reformation cases. Reformation cases are cases that you can bring in extrinsic evidence to determine what was the intent of the parties. That's the whole purpose of the reformation case. Secondly, I just want to say that, you know, I think we've discussed the ambiguity in this deed. I mean, clearly it was, the deed is ambiguous, and especially when you compare that to in a reformation case, when you're trying to get, you look back at the contract that was there, then you see that the contract does not comport with what the Mr. Fuqua's argument is correct. The contract.
Mr. Goss, if we are talking about reformation case, and this is truly a reformation, then we have a statute of limitations issue, don't we? That we need to address first before we get to the underlying case.
We do, and that's all that the court was addressing in the motion for summary judgment, because that's all that Ms. Martinez's motion for summary judgment said, that this is the statute of limitation has run. That's it. There was no motion for summary judgment on the breach of contract. There was no motion for summary judgment on the declaratory judgment. And our whole argument, Justice Benavides, is that there
is. So my question to you is, if you lose on the reformation case, how is your case still alive when it comes to a breach of contract? If you're dead on the reformation because you waited too long, what is still a live issue for us to address?
The partial performance of the contract. That the merger doctrine does not relate to partial performance of a contract where there's other distinct issues that need to be performed under the contract. In my example is, you have tract A and tract B in the contract, you only transfer tract A, you can still have a breach of contract on tract B because there was only partial performance. Cases are legion, and we've cited them that say, partial performance is an exception to the merger doctrine. You can only get to Mr. Fusco's conclusion if you say, well, Cosgrove applies, and that's the only thing that applies. And you can only do that if you say that this is an unambiguous deed, a complete omission of anything related to what we were asking for. And that's just simply not true. The deed reflects, in general terms, what the contract says. It just doesn't go the full method to say what happens once the loan is paid off. These are courts of equity as well. And what the courts are trying to get to is, what was the intent of the party? What we're saying is there's a question of fact as to what the intent of the parties was and whether or not that deed reflected the intent of the parties. And with regard to the statute of limitations, what Mr. Marsh is saying is there's no way that he could have known that he needed to do anything until he paid off the note, unless he went to a lawyer and said, hey, I need a legal interpretation of this. But in the Brown versus Havard case, the court concluded that the justices of Court of Appeal couldn't agree on what the deed said. Some justices on the Supreme Court couldn't agree what the deed said. It's unfair for a layperson to have to give a legal opinion as to what this says. He was told at the time, and that's what the affidavit said, he was told at the time that this did what the contract said. He paid off the loan. He immediately asked for the minerals to be transferred, and he filed suit within a year after he was told that the minerals would not be transferred. And so he has not delayed this at all. He thought that he was doing exactly what he was supposed to be doing. And as a court of equity, we would request strongly that you reverse the Court of Appeals. Let us have a fact issue on it to see what the intent of the parties was. Thank you.
Thank you.